Okay, so I want to talk about a new approach to what we call the direct statistical simulation of flows. And this is some work that I've done in collaboration with Greg Cheney and Steve Tobias. I'm going to first begin by talking about the cumulant expansion that we've been hearing about and how to go beyond this CE2. So I'll follow Jeff's lead and give you a second version of the title, Second Order Cumulant Expansions and Unhappiness. So I think unhappiness is actually should be valued more than it is, because it's when our solutions break down that we learn the most. And so that's kind of the point of view that we've been taking. So we can go back almost 50 years to a quote by Ed Lorenz, who was criticizing direct numerical simulation and suggesting that an alternative procedure which does not suffer from this disadvantage, and here the disadvantage he envisioned was that simulation looks too much like observation, consists of deriving a new system of equations whose unknowns are the statistics themselves. We probably could go back even further in time and find this program enunciated by people, perhaps even Lord Kelvin. But this is the general program that we call direct statistical simulation, which could take many different forms, and probably we haven't found the best way to think about this yet. But as you've seen in some of the talks today, there is some progress being made, I think. So I want to contrast this direct statistical simulation against numerical simulation, what we do traditionally. So often we find that low-order statistics like means or two-point correlations are smoother in space than any instantaneous snapshot of the flow, and we might be able to take advantage of that. The statistics might evolve slowly in time or not at all. We might be in a statistical steady state. And so they might be described by a fixed point or at least a slow manifold. But very important is that for many of the interesting systems in the universe, the correlations are non-local and highly anisotropic and inhomogeneous. So any statistical formulation we develop should respect this. So as we've seen this model many places already at this meeting, but I'll review it again, because I'll use this as one of my prototypes. So as a stochastically driven barotropic toy model of jets with some vorticity Coriolis parameter, I'm going to be working on the sphere. So my Coriolis parameter will depend on the sine of the latitude. And I'll be considering a decomposition into spherical harmonics, because I want to focus on zonal means. So this zonal wave number m is going to play a special role in what I discuss. And in particular, I want to think about triad interactions where a wave of zonal wave vector m1 and m2 come together and give me m1 plus m2. So we'll do a mean flow and eddy decomposition of some dynamical variable such as a vorticity into a component that has only the m equals 0 component and then everything else. And we can think of the triad interactions. We can break them up into the different classes. So for example, a wave bouncing off or interacting with a zonal flow is one such process. We can also have two waves of equal but opposite zonal wave vector combined to give us a contribution to the zonal flow. So that's the Reynolds forcing. And these two diagrams are the diagrams that are present in a quasi-linear treatment, or equivalently this second-order cumulant expansion, or the SSST. Then we have the general triad with two waves coming together and giving us another wave. So that will be included at higher order, and I'll tell you how to do that. And the basic idea here is that if we have a strong shearing in our mean flow, that will help to weaken the nonlinearities by shearing apart vorticity and hopefully weakening the importance of this diagram relevant with respect to these other triads. So let me just give you one slide with some details about how this is done, and then I'll be more schematic from then on. So we might consider a zonal average of three, a product of three fields. And this will vanish unless m1 plus m2 plus m3 equals 0. However, if that condition is met, then there are still some other possibilities. For example, one of these m's could be zero, in which case we can factorize it out. And we're left with what's basically the product of a second cumulant with a first cumulant. And so here, these two m's have to be equal and opposite. The complex conjugation, of course, is the same as minus m, so that this has zero net zonal wave vector. And so this second cumulant is labeled by only three indices instead of four if we didn't have a zonal symmetry. So the second order cumulant expansion just amounts to saying that this general product of three fields vanishes unless one of the entries here is zero, in which case it factorizes in this way. So that's an approximation, but it's a nice approximation because it leads to a closed set of equations, equations of motion for the first cumulant and the second cumulant involving linear terms. And then here's the triad interactions that are coupling, for example, the second cumulant to the first cumulant. And then here we have the second cumulant depends on the product of the first cumulant and the second cumulant, plus a term that we neglected, which is our closure approximation. So this is basically the same mathematics as the SSST of Farrow and Iannou. And I want to thank Bill Young for pointing this out to us because we weren't originally aware of this close connection between the two approaches. But I only have an approximate here because in our point of view of these equations, we're not going to add some stochastic forcing on top of this as a way of closing these equations. We'll simply investigate these together and see what they yield with the original forcing of the system and not try to tune it. So this may work or it may not. It depends on the situations. And we've heard a number of things about that. There's a number, quite a bit of work now on this problem, when CE2 might work or not. So instead of trying to improve CE2 by adding this additional forcing or damping, I'd like to go beyond by looking at higher cumulants. And so let me show you how that goes in a kind of schematic way. So look at the third order closure where we drop the fourth cumulant. So schematically, the equation of motion for the first cumulant has some forcing term plus some linear operators plus our triads, our quadratic interaction, involves the product of the two first cumulants and the second cumulant. Then we go down this hierarchy of cumulants. So the second cumulant equation of motion involves the product of the first and the second plus the third through this quadratic nonlinearity plus stochastic forcing. We can keep going. There's a third cumulant, which is going to involve the product of the first and the third, or 2 seconds, or the fourth cumulant. So it's turtles all the way down. We would keep on going, but we have to stop somewhere. So let's first of all assume that the fourth cumulant is zero or small. And as John mentioned yesterday, this is no longer realizable. So we have to do something to maintain the positivity of the second cumulant. And what we have found works well is to write it as in terms of its eigenbasis, and remove the eigenvectors corresponding to negative eigenvalues. Krechnin showed in 1980 that the second cumulant has to be. Any distribution that has a third cumulant is going to have fourth, fifth, and sixth cumulants. If we try to ask what is a distribution that has only these three cumulants, say in one dimension, we'll find that the PDF goes negative, which is obviously unphysical. So, and what this manifests itself in is if we integrate these equations naively without doing something, they'll blow up in general. So we found that if we make this onsatz, they'll often, or at least in the cases we've looked at, converge. And so I'll call this the CE3 approximation. But we can do something a little bit different, which is let's look at this equation for the third cumulant. And instead of just throwing away the fourth cumulant, let's make a model for it by saying that there's some eddy damping parameter, tau, which models the neglect of this fourth cumulant. And it just says that the third cumulant is being pushed back to zero by the this term. So there would have been some transfer of energy to this fourth cumulant, but we'll model it this way. And then we're going to butcher this equation in various ways. So the first thing is, let's assume that the dynamics of the third cumulant are very fast, so that we can set this time derivative to zero. And we'll eliminate this linear term, although that's not necessary. And we'll also throw out this term. And now we have a diagnostic equation for C3 in terms of C2, instead of a prognostic equation that we had before. So we can use this to solve for the third cumulant in terms of the second cumulant at the cost of introducing this phenomenological damping parameter and substitute that back in to the equation for the second cumulant. So we call this CE2.5, this is somewhere in between CE2 and CE3, but it's basically the eddy damp quasi-normal approximation now generalized to an anisotropic and inhomogeneous system. And it has some very nice properties. And if I have time, which I probably won't, I'll demonstrate it for you. But yes. I think it would be interesting. Yes. It was for convenience. And so this term doesn't arise, of course, in homogeneous turbulence, because there's no mean. But it would be very interesting to investigate its role. It's just that mathematically or technically, it's difficult to treat it. Yeah. And also, we'd like to include that term, possibly. OK, so this has some nice, these cumulant expansions have some nice properties. CE2 conserves quadratic invariance, energy and entropy in the absence of forcing and damping, and the total angular momentum. CE3 conserves the third Casimir before we do projection. And Wan Ming, my student, has shown that CEn conserves the Casimirs up to the nth order, the Casimirs being the integral of the vorticity to the nth power, and which are conserved under the exact dynamics. I should say CE2.5 conserves energy and entropy also. So it's a conservative approximation. Prior to removing the negative eigenvectors, the eigenvectors that have negative eigenvalues. Once we do that, we ruin energy conservation. So the cost of having this procedure with no phenomenological parameters is that we violate these conservation laws. But they're rather weak violations in some cases. Right. So when I assume that this third cumulant's dynamics are very fast, C3 dot was zero, allowing me to solve. So I just sort of leapt through all of that. Now, CE2 is realizable. And it appears, numerically anyway, that CE2.5 is realizable. We don't have a proof for this, as there is in the case for the isotropic and homogeneous problem. And John, a number of years ago, showed that in the anisotropic but still homogeneous problem, EDQNM can be generalized to be realizable. But we don't have a general proof for the inhomogeneous problem. I think that would be an interesting thing to try to prove. But based on simply numerical experiments that we've done, it seems to have only positive eigenvalues for the second cumulant and is well behaved. And I already mentioned this way of fixing up CE3. So let's see how it works. So here's our stochastically generated jet. This has forcing that's mainly concentrated at the low latitudes. And you'll see the reason for that in a moment. This is just the full numerical simulation. And if we look at the zonal velocity as a function of time, here we see that we started off with two westerly jets that merged as the energy in the system built. And then we got a statistical steady state. At this time of 500 days, I've started time averaging. So we have a westerly zonal flow and then easterly backflow at high latitudes. So here's a plot of the zonal means as calculated by the direct numerical simulation and some of our approximations. The dark line is basically truth, quote unquote, from our full numerical simulation. The red line is CE2, and you can see it qualitatively seems to get this jet right, but it doesn't have sufficient flow at high latitudes. And that's because there's no forcing there, and CE2, by neglecting the eddy-eddy interaction, is not transmitting angular momentum up to those high latitudes. When we go to these higher order approximations, then we have scattering at these higher latitudes, and we do better at describing the jet, although perhaps not of quantitative accuracy yet. Now, there's an interesting numerical experiment we can do that illustrates the limitations of CE2. Here I've started with an initial condition that has a backwards jet, a negative jet going on the equator. And CE2 maintains that negative jet, the wrong jet, the jet that's going the wrong direction for any period of time. And in fact, it starts to oscillate. There's some unphysical zonal oscillations. And you can see, furthermore, that the jet does not extend up to the high latitudes, which is what I told you about was the case for CE2. Now, at time 300, I turn on CE2.5, and it reverses the jet to the correct configuration and extends the backflow up to the high latitudes as it should. And the oscillations disappear, which is what they should do. Basically, there's some additional damping from these eddy-eddy interactions. So this is the zonal mean oscillating, but the eddies are the, if we look at the second order statistic, it's also oscillating back and forth. Yeah. Okay, so some of the other speakers have shown you slides about their book. But I have an app, and my app is free. You can download it, and you can try this out. You can do CE2 and CE3 and direct numerical simulation, and I'm about to release a new version, which will have CE2.5 available for your simulating pleasure. Okay, so now I want to tell you about something new we've been working on that I think does better than this type of traditional approach to cumulants. And so one of the problems of the cumulants expansions when we go to these higher orders is they get very slow because we have to compute these triad interactions involving these higher order statistics. So we'd like something that is faster, and we'd also like to achieve better accuracy. We've gotten some pretty good qualitative accuracy, but can we get quantitative accuracy? And so this, a possible solution comes from, at least to me, a somewhat surprising direction, which is in thinking about the problem of modeling subgrid physics, something that Greg Cheney has been thinking about and talked about earlier in this conference. So one of the problems in climate, for instance, that we might very much like to understand is the low marine boundary layer clouds, such as are off of the coast of Santa Barbara, especially if you're here in June for the June gloom. If we zoom in, then we have this extensive field of stratocumulus clouds. Here's California and Baja. And we see some structure here. And there's structure at all sorts of different length scales. This is now actually San Francisco. Again, all this fine structure. And if we zoom in even further, still structure. So it's going to be hopeless to directly include that into a full GCM simulation. Can we develop a statistical model of such clouds? And can we incorporate such a statistical model naturally, seamlessly into a GCM? So one of the students here has at our conference, Bettina Meyer, has been starting to do some work on applying cumulant expansions to just these kinds of cloud problems. So this kind of serves as some inspiration for a modified version of our statistical approach that seems, I'll show you some preliminary results that seem promising. And that is, I'm going to again separate the triads into long and short zonal scales. But this time, I'm not going to only have the m equals 0 component separated off from the non-m components. But instead, I'm going to keep components with m less than some small cutoff. So typically maybe 3. And I'm going to treat these modes fully nonlinearly. I'll have the full triad interaction. And then the other triads will have processes where these low M modes scatter off of high M modes. Or here's the analog of the Reynolds forcing. We have two high M modes that can give us not just some contribution to the zonal flow, but also to some of the long wavelength zonal modes. But I'm going to throw out all of these terms, and especially this one involving the scattering of two high wave number modes giving me another wave number mode. And the reason for throwing those out is that now I'll be able to close this system of equations. So I'll call this a generalized CE2 expansion for lack of a better term, although maybe we'll come up with something better. So if I start with my equation of motion here in terms of a linear operator and a quadratic operator, I'll break up the dynamical variable into a low wave number part and a high wave number part, and then insert it into this form, assuming that we throw out some of the triad interactions. So the time evolution of the low mode involves two high modes and two low modes, for instance, but not a low and a high mode. Similarly, the time evolution of the high mode involves a low and a high, but not two highs. And that allows me to close the equations, because if I multiply by another high mode, I can take the time evolution of that, and it only involves also two high modes, not three. So if I have the full dynamics of the low modes, then I can close this equation and solve directly for these statistics. So how well, so this has some connection, as I mentioned, to some work that Greg described earlier. And Bacchus and Ioannou have considered a kind of ensemble average, which might have some rough connection to this. So let's see how well it does on that jet problem. So there's our jet and the zonal average. The green line is CE2, and the red line is our new approximation to the zonal mean compared to the so-called truth. This is where I have included three modes in my low modes. Part of the reason why this works is because we notice the jet tends to have some very long wavelength modulations on it, and we're capturing that now in this approximation. If we look at the power spectra in CE2, which is this lambda equals zero limit, we get this unphysical Rossby-type wave that develops because of the lack of eddy-eddy scattering. But in our approximation, we get something that looks very close in the second order statistic. We can look at two-point correlations of the vorticity correlating this point on the equator to the other regions in space. So we have positive correlations in the vorticity right around that point, and then some wave-like pattern that dies off. In CE2, the correlations are much too strong, again, because of the neglect of wave-wave interactions. And in this new approximation, we get a very good agreement. We've applied this to a two-layer primitive equation on the sphere, driven by a Held-Suarez-type forcing that leads to a kind of Earth-like motion. So here are the eddies in the mid-latitudes in the jets. We have some easterly trade winds. Here's the zonal mean velocity. And black line here is our truth, the full numerical simulation. The dotted line is actually a high-resolution run on a geodesic grid, showing that the resolution is sufficient pretty much in the spectral cutoff we've chosen. The red line is our new GCE2. The green line is CE2, which does quite poorly in getting the jet positions and widths. And this M equals 3 run is simply what would happen if I only keep the low modes and don't have any coupling to the subgrid model. So showing that the subgrid physics, the high modes, are really doing something non-trivial. If we look at the two-point correlation of the vorticity in the southern hemisphere here around 45 degrees south, here's our full simulation. CE2 does quite miserably because, again, it has much too strong waves due to the lack of wave-wave interaction. Here's our new approximation. And then if we look at some observation, even though it's kind of pushing it for such a simple model, this comes from reanalysis data, ECMWF, done by my student Florian Sabot at mid-latitudes. And we see the sort of characteristic signature of a baroclinic eddy. Okay, so let me just conclude with some observations. What we found is a systematic approximation that becomes exact in the limit that we retain all of our modes, but it's often accurate, apparently, for even a very small number of modes. And it's faster than these CE2.5 and CE3. It's a conservative approximation because it came from simply decimating some of the triads. And when we do that, then we can easily maintain conservation laws for at least for the quadratic, linear and quadratic invariants. It's realizable as a positive probability distribution function. And it's well suited, as Greg Cheney pointed out, these kinds of things, these multi-scale calculations are well suited for parallel computation. And so something that I've begun to explore is moving some of this onto the GPU through OpenCL. So thank you very much.
We have time for some comments or questions. Bill, I think you were first.
Brad, were you saying that with GCE2, it's no longer necessary to worry about third order cumulants?
That's right.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah, because we're getting some of that physics in by the nonlinearities that we're including in the low modes. That's allowing some cascade to occur because those low modes can repeatedly act to help transfer energy between the high modes.
Yeah. Is this amenable to nesting? So if you have a local area that you want to examine much more, you could have even higher order wave numbers involved. Does that make any sense?
Possibly, yeah. I haven't thought about that yet. And we need to think about more sophisticated, well, trying to do a real subgrid model where we have some different type of physics, such as the cloud physics, integrated into the general circulation. But that's work of the future. Yeah.
Is what you're doing the following? If not, could you do this? Could you essentially make a low-resolution GCM and use your scheme as a subgrid scale parameterization?
That's the hope, basically, yes. So we would treat these high modes as our subgrid model, and we're doing CE2 on them, essentially. That would feed into the low-resolution GCM, giving you something that is looks like high-resolution simulation. So that's what this simple two-layer model suggests, but we have a lot to do before we can really demonstrate that or test that.
So presumably, although here lambda equals 3 worked well, in general it won't. Would it be feasible to try doing this sort of thing for lambda equals 1, 2, 3, and keep on going until it converges?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
So I should have emphasized that. Yeah, so say you aren't allowed to run your high resolution model because it just exceeds your computational resources, but you could do this and then see you're still, one, lambda is 1, it differs from lambda equals 2, but then lambda equals 3 is getting close, and hopefully it converges. Then you might be satisfied that you're accurately representing things.
Is running lambda 1 through, say, 10 cheaper than doing the CE3 or CE2.5?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. There's fewer indices that one has to. So the third cumulant has, even with zonal symmetry, has 5 indices. And trying to drag that around through the calculations is intense.
Your last method for incorporating the mean eddy triads, it's in a completely homogeneous flow. Those kind of terms are sometimes simplified analytically into what look like diffusion terms in wave number space. Can you get any way toward that with your formulation?
I don't know. I think that's a very good suggestion to think about, because anything we can do to simplify that subgrid model, perhaps by using some diffusive closures, could greatly speed up things. And those are the sort of problems I'm hoping to work on when I get a chance back here.
Thanks. And would these models get the K-spectrum right?
Yeah, so I showed you subspectra. I went through that pretty quickly. Let me just back up to that. So this was for the barotropic jet. And so what I should have explained what I'm plotting here. So this is the spherical wave number L, and this is the zonal wave number M. And this is the vorticity power spectra. And so this is the input of energy from the stochastic forcing. And this is the zonal mean developing at m equals 0. And you can see a kind of a cascade coming down. And actually, there's also some diffusion up to the higher m's spreading out through spectral space. It's a little bit hard to see on the screen here. So here is CE2, where we don't have this cascade physics. We only have this direct process. And so there's no way for energy that's put in at these values of m to go up to smaller scales. And it can cascade directly down to here. And then if a non-trivial zonal flow develops, then an instability to Rossby waves can form. And that's what we're seeing here. But it's exaggerated. It's too strong compared to this. So now when we go to this improved version of CE2, where we treat these low modes non-linearly, then we get a spectrum that looks quite close to the full spectrum.
OK, Pascal, final question.
Make it a good one.
I'm still not sure I understand why the generalized CE2 is still faster than CE2.5.
OK, so this object that involves the two-point correlations here, involving products of the high modes, this is where most of the computation is occurring. And now, because we don't have zonal symmetry, this is each of these two fields in two dimensions has two coordinates, so there's a total of four coordinates. When we look at the third cumulant has a total of six coordinates, because there's three fields, each of which are two-dimensional, but there's a zonal symmetry, which reduces that to five dimensions. So one answer to that question is this is four-dimensional instead of five-dimensional, which makes a huge difference. But left unanswered is, can we integrate this very quickly? That's the same problem that Greg Cheney discussed in his talk. And that's something that we're working on. But one thing that I can say right away is that this is very easy to parallelize. It's independent calculation. So just as a computational matter, it's possible to speed this up greatly. So that's a kind of practical answer, but I think there's some algorithmic things that can be done to improve the speed of that integration too. And just because of the lower dimensionality, it's faster than CE2.5 or CE3.
Okay, so it's time for the photograph. So let's thank both our speakers again. And we're gonna go out of here and out of the front door and onto the lawn at the front, I think.